Timothy Ray Brown grew up in Seattle, but in 1995 he was living in Europe, and a friend of his convinced him he should get an HIV test. So he did, and he was positive. At that time, those test results meant only one thing.
If you got HIV, you knew you were going to die. The friend of mine that told me I should get tested said, you know, we've only got about 2 more years to live. And in fact, a lot of people cashed in their life insurance policies.
But soon, new treatments for HIV hit the market. And as with so many people with the virus, HIV became something he could live with. Incurable, but manageable. Well, I'm Gabriel Spitzer. It's Sound Effect on KPLU. And to get at what makes Timothy Ray Brown unusual, you have to fast forward about a decade. Timothy was working as a translator in Germany, and one day he went to ride his bike to lunch.
So I was riding my bike there, and got halfway to the restaurant, I had to stop because I didn't have energy. And I called my partner. I said, I need to see a doctor.
That doctor told him he had acute myeloid leukemia and aggressive blood cancer. And once again, Brown was confronted with a bleak diagnosis.
So that was my second death sentence.
But Timothy's oncologist was no ordinary doctor, and Dr. Gero Hütter had an idea.
Something called a CCR5 delta 32 deletion. It's a mutation which makes the person carrying it almost immune to HIV. So he said, I think that maybe I could not only get rid of your leukemia, I could also maybe get rid of your HIV.
Brown went for it. Though at times he must have wished he hadn't, because what followed was intense chemotherapy to purposefully destroy his immune system, and then an infusion of bone marrow cells with that key mutation, then radiation, followed by something called graft versus host disease, which forced him to do the whole damn thing over again and get another transplant. It nearly killed him, more than once. But at the end, he was cancer-free, and his blood showed no signs of HIV. But HIV is one of the sneakiest of viruses. It can hide in ordinary cells all over the body. So before they could pronounce Brown cured, they needed to do some brutal detective work.
They did quite a few biopsies. They did a biopsy on my brain. Colonoscopies, a very invasive colonoscopy, where they went into my gut. They also took out a lymph node out of my groin. They didn't find any HIV in my body.
The virus was gone. Timothy Ray Brown had become the first person in the world cured of this incurable disease. And with the achievement of this once impossible dream, it seemed like maybe we finally had this scourge of AIDS on the run. Well, that was about 8 years ago, and now Timothy Ray Brown is still the only one ever cured, the one member of a very lonely club.
Unfortunately, there haven't been any that have actually taken, and I'd really like there to be. And so it's a very, very small club, and I'd like to have more people in my club.
Today on Sound Effect, exceptions to the rule. We'll talk about what it feels like to be an outlier as a frightened patient or an athlete or a champion of the undergoat. It's all ahead on Sound Effect from KPLU. Don't go away. So now we're going to talk about what you make of a case like Timothy's. Keith Jerome is a virologist at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center in the University of Washington, and he's trying to translate Timothy's success into a broader cure. For a scientist like Jerome, this kind of exception to the rule is really exciting, but also really frustrating. You know, medicine depends on reproducibility, on integrating an exception like Timothy's into the rule itself. Well, I met him in his office overlooking Lake Union in Seattle, and Keith Jerome explained to me how he first learned of Timothy's case.
I remember seeing the New York Times article, actually, and I know that there's actually some interesting stories behind that because it really initially didn't get a lot of play in the scientific literature. It was this odd case, and I think nobody knew what to make of it, and it really took a little bit of thought from people who were maybe outside of the medical field itself to say, wow, this seems like something that's really cool and potentially important. there got to be a lot of excitement really quickly. I mean, you didn't have to explain twice to people that if there was someone, anyone who was cured of HIV, this was a big deal.
Did you believe it right away?
As scientists, we're trained to be skeptical. You're particularly trained to be skeptical of dramatic claims. So a cure of HIV is certainly a dramatic claim. On the other hand, this was a reputable institution, a reputable bunch of physicians. And subsequently, Timothy Brown has been studied by the top laboratories in the world. And the consensus of everybody who's looked is he's cured of HIV.
So I think to a layperson, it seems like this has been the holy grail, a cure for HIV, and now someone has been cured. So are we done? You know, it sort of seems like that's it. You have found the pot of gold. How would you contextualize that?
Well, the context of that's really easy. The goal here isn't to have a scientist be able to stand up and say, look at me, I cured someone of HIV. The goal is to cure everyone of HIV. We're not done until this virus is no longer on the radar screen of humanity.
So what are some of the reasons that Timothy's case so far is still a single case and hasn't been replicated?
This is an extreme case, something that we so desperately want that then we're teased with because it happens once, and then as a field we can't make it happen again. First of all, what Timothy had that cured him was a bone marrow transplant, essentially, and we really only do that for life-threatening illnesses like cancer. This is an incredibly toxic process that he had to go through. It was not easy, and he will tell you how difficult this was. It's certainly been tried to do this, but you can only try this in folks who have HIV and an HIV-associated malignancy, and that's a subset of people. Most people, particularly in our part of the world who have HIV, do well with it. We can get people on suppressive therapy, and they live very healthy lives with HIV. It's not true in other parts of the world necessarily where they don't have access to drug. So there's a limited subset of people who you would ever dream of trying this. You have to have an AIDS-associated cancer. Then even among those people, there's the genetic challenges to find the right matched donor who could provide cells to that person. And then they have to have this very special magic gene deletion that basically disrupts the door that HIV would use to get into new cells. So if all those things line up, then you can try this. And even in that situation, you're talking about incredibly sick people who have a bad virus and then have cancer on top of it. And, unfortunately, those people have a lot of cards stacked against them, and we as a field have not had the success to be able to reproduce Timothy's experience.
And when you say that, I mean, it has been tried in individuals. What's happened to them?
To the best of my knowledge, all the patients who've had bone marrow transplants with this kind of donor with this right deletion have ultimately died of their cancer.
So what's the value of a case like this, given that it's so difficult to reproduce?
I think it's incredibly valuable. It's valuable, first of all, just because it reminds workers in the field, the scientists and the doctors, that cure is possible. Here is a real person who's been cured. And the field has changed dramatically. Only a few years ago, it was a little bit outside the mainstream to even be proposing to do scientific research on cure. I mean, people will still take you seriously as a scientist, but it would have been perceived as a bit odd.
Because that just seemed out of the realm of possibility. People were working on how to manage it or how to reduce the symptoms, right?
Yeah, I think that people would say, sure, it would be great to have a cure, but it's impossible, or it's so far off in the future that you're wasting your time. You should be working on something where you have a chance of success. But once you can point to someone who has been cured, suddenly it's much less abstract. And we say, okay, if it's possible, I'm really working on trying to bring this to tens of patients or hundreds or millions. And it's harder to argue against that. And the other thing that this has really done is not about the physicians and the scientists, but it's about the community, and it's about people who've been affected by HIV in so many ways. we've done community events where we've introduced our science and what we're trying to achieve and just educational things, where Timothy's been our headline draw. And it was one of the most dramatic and emotional experiences in my life. I got to introduce Timothy, and the way that he was bringing hope, tangible hope, to people who've been affected by this virus was just incredibly moving. And I think that as much as we as scientists and physicians get motivated by this, I think really as people we all get motivated by this, that this incredibly dramatic scourge, this HIV that we've dealt with for decades now, maybe we can see the end. And that's what Timothy represents, the potential end of this virus.
Well, Keith Jerome of the University of Washington and Fred Hutch, thanks so much.
All right, it's my pleasure.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today's theme is exceptions to the rule. Well, almost 10 years ago in Seattle, the only way you could have fresh milk in your refrigerator was, you know, to buy it at the store or get it at the farmer's market. But today, if you want to, you can squirt milk right into your mouth. That is, if you have a pet goat in your backyard. A woman named Jenny Grant paved the way for legalizing goats in Seattle. She had set out to just bend the law a little, so she could keep her illegal urban farm. She would have been happy with just a special variance or something, but then when she couldn't be the exception, she ended up changing the rule itself. And in the process, she took the farm-to-table movement to a whole new level. KPLU's Jennifer Wing shares Grant's story.
Jenny Grant craved fresh goat's milk. She got a taste of it in California and was surprised it wasn't musty. Grant knew goats in Seattle weren't legal, but she got one anyway, a white mini La Mancha. She named her Snowflake.
Well, the rule said that you couldn't keep farm animals such as sheep or cows. And so I thought, well, what is a farm animal? I mean, dogs and cats were originally farm animals. I mean, if you love your goat and you take them on a walk periodically and you fuss over them, aren't they a pet also?
Grant was able to keep Snowflake under the radar for a while in her backyard in Madrona until a young girl about a mile away got really sick.
With what they thought was Q fever. And she was hospitalized. She could have died.
Q fever is a bacterial infection spread by goats and cows. It can make someone seriously ill if they have a weak immune system. The girl's family started asking neighbors if someone nearby had goats.
I said, yes, there is a woman with goats in the neighborhood.
So the health department came.
They saw that the goats hadn't spread the disease, that my goats had never had this disease. And then later they found out that she didn't even have Q fever.
Snowflake was innocent. But now the city was on to what was going on in Grant's backyard.
Once I was turned in, I got a note on my porch that said, we understand that you have goats on the premises and you got to get rid of them.
Grant was not going to let that happen. Not only did she have Snowflake, she had Snowflake's newborn kids to think about. She asked the city, can't you just let this slide by?
I was looking for an exception to the rule. But they said, no, we got to just change the rule, which it kind of makes sense.
So why was owning a goat in Seattle against the law? Well, city leaders started putting restrictions on farm animals 90 years ago, back when Seattle was growing and changing more than it is today. Around the turn of the last century, urban and bucolic existed side by side. On the way to a performance at the Grand Opera House on Cherry Street, it would not have been unusual to see a child grazing cows on empty lots. Back then, Seattle had hundreds of cows, horses, and a handful of goats.
So the city had city herders who worked under the police department.
That's Fred Brown. He's writing a book due out next year called The City is More Than Human, an Animal History of Seattle.
And there was a cattle pound, which was the equivalent of the dog pound. And the cattle pound was where cattle and horses that were roaming unattended would be taken there.
Brown says Seattle's quest to become a more sophisticated and upper middle class town led to laws banning all farm animals, unless you owned a sizable piece of property in town. By 1957, even chickens weren't spared. From Grant's perspective, not only did these laws openly express dislike for the poor who lived off the land, they were also land grabs from real estate developers looking to make a fortune.
So they came up with ideas that it was unsafe for children and women and so forth, and they passed laws to get rid of the farm animals. Because once you couldn't keep a farm animal in the city, you had to move out of the city, and then what did you have to do with your land? You had to sell it to a real estate developer.
Over the years, a bit of the country has crept back into the city. Chickens, ducks, and turkeys made it back first in 1982. It wasn't until 2007 that goats got their day. Grant got together with other goat enthusiasts and created the Goat Justice League. Their mission? To convince the Seattle City Council that people had a right to own goats. The council said yes, unanimously, but with a few conditions. Only 2 goats per household. They have to be 100 pounds or less. No horns are allowed, and the males have to be castrated. Since her victory, Grant is now known as the Goat Lady.
When people say, oh, you're the Goat Lady, I always have to say, well, some people call me Jenny Grant.
She went on to write a book called City Goats, the Goat Justice League's Guide to Backyard Goat Keeping. And Snowflake had her moment of fame, too. The Stranger put her on the cover when Seattle voters approved gay marriage.
Something about, like, the anti-gay marriage people were arguing that if they let gay men marry men, that men would soon want to marry goats. So it was sort of a play on that. Apparently nobody got it, but Snowflake got to be on the cover.
And one of Snowflake's grandsons
works for Rent-A-Ruminant, and they were on the Stephen Colbert Report, that herd, the Rent-A-Ruminant herd for goats stealing Americans' jobs.
Goats, if you're going to steal our landscaping jobs, humans are going to start producing feta cheese.
Even though the door to goat ownership has been open for several years, not too many people are taking advantage of it. In the 83.9 square miles of Seattle, there are only 46 licensed goats and 3 potbelly pigs. Back in Madrona and Grant's backyard, it's late in the day and it's milking time. Snowflake now has another goat, Eloise, to keep her company. All goats are herd animals and require companions. They live at the bottom of the terraced backyard. Lake Washington is just below us. Henry and Lucy, my 2 kids, are here to try out their milking skills.
Ooh, may I try?
Yep. You want to go on that side of her, Lucy?
I remember how to do it.
Okay, you take that, so you pinch off the top and then squeeze the bottom. Henry, don't sweat your sister. All right, Henry. Henry, open your mouth. Get closer.
Henry's not so sure about having goat's milk squirted directly into his mouth.
You don't want it in your mouth?
No,
it's the freshest milk there is.
We get about a quart of milk from Grant's other goat, Eloise. In the summer, she produces a gallon a day. Some of it ends up as delicious cheese. It's getting dark, so we round up Grant's chickens and put the goats into their shed. There's a deck at the top that the goats like to hop up on. It has a gorgeous view of the lake. Grant says if you decide to keep goats, you should give them the best view possible, so you can enjoy it too. She warns that you'll be spending more time there than any other part of your garden, milking, feeding, watering, and sweeping. For Grant, the bond with the animals and the access to fresh food is all worth the work. And while she's very proud of what she's done to make goats legal, she says the law does have some flaws. Yes, you can own a goat or 2, but walking them around the neighborhood on a leash, that's still illegal.
That story from KPLU's Jennifer Wing. It's Sound Effect on KPLU. Gabriel Spitzer here. We're talking today about exceptions to the rule. So the law is supposed to be consistent and fair. It should apply to everybody equally, right? But of course, our laws are riddled with exemptions and loopholes and special cases. And this seems to come up a lot whenever the law intersects with sports. Sports have such a powerful hold on our culture that lawmakers will do a lot to keep fans and teams happy. Even the U.S. Supreme Court exempted pro baseball from antitrust laws, and that was way back in 1922. Well, here in Washington State, we have our very own exception to the rule when it comes to sports. KPLU's Ashley Gross has been digging into why.
In Washington State, our Minimum Wage Act defines who is an employer and who's an employee. That's how the state figures out who should get paid the minimum wage. Well, as of July of this year, the law includes this exception. Here's Governor Jay Inslee signing the bill.
It specifies that employee does not include an individual who is at least 16 years old and under 21 years of age in his or her capacity as a player for a junior ice hockey team that is a member of a regional, national, or international league, and that it is one that contracts with an arena owned, operated, or managed by a public facilities district.
Did you catch all that? Here's the plain English version. Guys who play in the Western Hockey League, meaning the Everett Silvertips, the Seattle Thunderbirds, the Spokane Chiefs, and the Tri-City Americans, are not employees. They don't qualify to get paid minimum wage, and they also don't fall under the state's child labor laws. The whole idea is that these guys are amateurs, not pros. But if you really look at it, are they? Even fans going to the Everett Silvertips home opener are not so sure.
Does it feel like you're going to see a pro team or an amateur team?
More like a pro team. Yeah.
Why does it feel like that?
Oh, because they're professional. They practice every week.
Look at all the spirit.
Yeah. I would call it semi-professional.
Definitely it feels more like a pro team. There's a lot of community pride for them.
Does it seem like you're coming to see a professional sports team, or does it feel like it's an amateur sports team?
Middle, both.
A little extra dose, a bump and circumstances.
Inside, fans who have paid as much as $40 for a seat wave green glow sticks and shake cowbells. As each Silvertip player skates out onto the ice before the game, little fireworks go off. People stand in line to buy jerseys, and Fox Sports 1380 broadcasts the game live.
Across the box, Lauren Sell centering a shot by leadoff, safe rebound, score!
Here's how we got this kind of odd carve-out in our labor law for a group of hockey players. About 2 years ago, a guy in Canada named Glenn Gumbly, who had been involved with an effort to unionize hockey players, filed a complaint with Washington's Department of Labor and Industries. He said Western Hockey League teams, which are for-profit businesses, were breaking state child labor and minimum wage laws. He said they were paying a stipend that worked out to about a dollar an hour. The department started a child labor investigation. News of that was like a thunderbolt in the hockey world. Some lawmakers took notice.
Can I get you to introduce yourself so I can see how the voice level is?
Sure. State Representative Drew McEwen.
McEwen is a Republican who grew up playing hockey. He sponsored the House bill.
It was really to clarify our law to ensure that amateur players are not employees and not subject to minimum wage or to other labor laws.
So his bill said state minimum wage law, child labor protections, they just don't apply to these hockey players. The men running the teams trekked to Olympia to say, please, we need this. Here's Everett Silvertips president Gary Gillinas.
This issue is so significant that it would negatively impact our ability to stay and operate in the state of Washington. It would force us to continue to look at our business practice, and likely without this bill passing, would have to evaluate whether or not we could continue to stay in the state of Washington.
The teams all said, we can't function if these labor laws apply to our players. Republicans and Democrats in Olympia don't agree on much these days, but sports, that's something they can agree on. Here's Representative Mia Gregerson. She's a Democrat who represents Kent, where the Thunderbirds play.
I just want to say how much I do support this bill, and I'm sorry that my name isn't on it, and go Thunderbirds.
The bill became law. 3 weeks later, the Department of Labor and Industries closed its investigation. A spokesman says the law addressed the issues in the complaint. But if you look at the investigation file from LNI, we're talking almost 1,000 pages. It's clear that while they were investigating, state officials didn't think it was so clear-cut. Maybe the players should count as employees. The teams are for profit. One person who definitely thinks that is Lucas Walter from Langley, British Columbia. How old were you when you first started with the WHL?
I was 18.
Walter's hockey career in the WHL included 2 years with the Tri-City Americans. He's now suing the league. He says they broke minimum wage laws in Canada and the U.S. WHL Commissioner Ron Robison declined to comment, but he did say in an email, We are vigorously defending the league and our player experience. Walter says he got $70 a week his first season with the Americans and $85 a week in his second. If you divide that by the hours he spent on the ice and in buses, it works out to $1 to $2 an hour. He says when he found out that was how much he'd get, he was surprised.
I thought, whoa, I need to take a loan from my parents. Because, I mean, $70 a week, even your gas money, and maybe it's going to get you a Subway here and there, but not a whole lot, right?
And being involved with hockey 40 to even 65 hours a week doesn't exactly leave much time for a part-time job. Like Walter, most of the players are from Canada. They range in age from 16 to 20, and they stay with host families. Guys who haven't graduated yet go to high school. The teams pay for their food and their travel and promise to pay for at least some college tuition after the guys leave the league if they don't go pro. But under agreements the players sign, they don't make money from things like jerseys with their names on them or trading cards or even video games. Walter discovered he was in some games. So you could like play yourself in the game?
Yeah, I could play as myself in the video game, yeah. And then, yeah, like I at least thought, I was like, wow, we should at least get a free copy of this game if they're putting us in it, right?
The very best players in the Western Hockey League get drafted into the National Hockey League. It's not a formal farm system like minor league baseball is, but Sports Press Northwest commentator Art Teal says it's similar enough that the junior hockey players should be considered pros, just like minor league baseball players. Even the NCAA considers WHL players to be pros.
The WHL kids, despite their youth and despite their this, you know, antiquated notion of amateurism, are being hosed. They deserve a salary. Maybe it's going to be a minimal one, but whether it's $15 an hour or whatever, yeah, they deserve to be treated as the professionals, because this is a professional organization. It's designed to create professional players.
Well, we definitely are trying to develop professional players.
That's Russ Farwell. He's general manager of the Seattle Thunderbirds. He says the whole goal is to help the guys get good enough to make the NHL draft. But he says his players are amateurs, and they're not employees. He says that money the players get is just reimbursement for travel and training expenses.
It's not a wage. It's not calculated on time or anything.
The biggest issue, he says, is not so much minimum wage, but child labor laws. If his players were subject to those, it'd be hard to have 16 and 17-year-olds on his team. That would mean the Thunderbirds and other Washington teams would lose out on the most talented young players. That would make the teams less and less competitive.
They couldn't have played on our team because they couldn't, they can't work after 10 o'clock and they can't travel and they couldn't, you know, if you viewed them as employees, then they couldn't play hockey here.
In Linwood, 11 and 12-year-old hockey players are hard at work practicing.
Forwards line up on the boards. We're going to start with one person in front of the net. You're the D-man.
Regan Mueller is their coach. He played for the Thunderbirds as a forward in the 1990s. He had dreams of getting into the NHL, but discovered he had a heart murmur, so he hung up his skates and went to UW instead. The Thunderbirds gave him a scholarship. Mueller says he doesn't understand the minimum wage argument. He says just like high school football players, he pushed himself and can't imagine having to clock in and out for that.
You go and you voluntarily get up in the morning and you do push-ups and you do sit-ups, and I would voluntarily go to the rink during the day and I would skate for 2 hours, and I would voluntarily spend my summers doing two-a-days. I'd get up in the morning, I'd work out, and I'd get up in the afternoon, because that's what you have to do to excel at any sport in the world.
Still, there is a difference, right? High school football players play for a school. Players in the Western Hockey League play for for-profit businesses. But Mueller says the teams are not making giant profits. And he says players get a lot. The promise of college tuition, room and board, expensive skates and sticks.
At the end of the day, I think those kids are more than compensated for what they do and for what they get from it.
Still, outside Xfinity Arena in Everett, Silvertips fans are torn. Some say no, the players are definitely amateurs. They don't need to get paid. But I was surprised by how many said, heck yeah, pay them.
Do you feel like they should earn minimum wage?
Yes, I do.
I hope they would make a wage, and I hope it wouldn't be minimum wage. I feel they should make more. They're very dedicated.
I think probably should be a little bit more than minimum wage with the beating they take.
Really off Elenick, deflecting deep into the Spokane zone, and Kayla Yamamoto is hammered by Matt Fontaine. The Chiefs didn't like that, and Dominic Zwerger.
That story from KPLU's Ashley Gross. If you want to learn more about this exception to the rule, we'll have a bunch of information at our website, kplusoundeffect.org.
In the opening period, and Kayla Yamamoto about tattooed into Lake Stevens. And we'll see here what happens as far as penalties are concerned.
Yeah, I want to see the replay because I think it might have been Jake Christensen that Yamamoto tried to put a shoulder into. Yep.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today's show is all about exceptions to the rule. So this is the story of what it's like to discover you're exceptional in the worst kind of way, and then to find out you may actually be a very different kind of uncommon case. Janelle and Warren Langford got married in the summer of 2013. It was about a year into their marriage at this point where you know each other very well, but the marriage hasn't really been tested yet. Then Janelle started having trouble seeing. Warren would point things out to her, like people they knew or beautiful birds.
And I just did not see it. And he's like, you should really get glasses before school starts.
Janelle had recently been accepted to the graphic design program at Seattle Central College. And doing design, you need to be able to see. Her optometrist was stumped, and so she went to an ophthalmologist, and he had some bad news.
The ophthalmologist that I got literally scared the shit out of me. Like he literally didn't have any kind of bedside manners. He just kind of did this thing where he's just like, oh, I just cannot figure it out. And then did a bunch of tests on me and then decided that I was going blind. That's literally what he said. He was like, it looks like you have macular degeneration. I can't tell you how long you have before that happens.
So now Janelle is looking at a future where she is a blind person. Now, macular degeneration is not that uncommon. About 1% of people over 40 have some form of it. And not everyone goes blind right away. But remember, Janelle is in her 20s, and macular degeneration is a disease of the elderly. Some years, the National Eye Institute reports zero cases of it in people under 40. So it seems like Janelle is a very unlucky exception to the rule. The vision problems and the stress were making it very hard to keep up with her studies. And of course, there was this dread that her health was going to wrench her career away anyway.
And I just couldn't figure out what to do next. Like, I thought I had a plan, and then I had to like redesign that plan. And I was feeling a little hopeless because I didn't know how to do that. And I was angry.
Janelle went in for some tests to confirm her diagnosis, and she was in for a surprise. It was not macular degeneration, but it actually was a related disease called Stargardt's. And that would explain the whole not being 70 years old thing, but Stargardt's presents the opposite problem. It's usually a disease of the very young. So she's a different kind of exception. But there wasn't much comfort in that because most people with Stargardt's go legally blind by midlife. Months went by as she tried to absorb this news, and meanwhile, her eyes were getting worse.
It felt like my eyes were rolling back in my head. And I also had the more of the floaters and the little tiny lights everywhere around people and on people and around people in really bright rooms.
So this is in May, and she calls her husband, Warren, and here's what she tells him.
I can't get through the day because it's like impossible for me to get anything done because it's really, really bothering me. And he said, okay, and he hangs up the phone and he gets on the phone with
There's the eye clinic. Eye Institute, yeah.
And he said, either I'm going to go to the emergency room or I'm going to come to you. It's affecting her work. And now she's actually feeling pressure and it's actually hurting her.
They somehow squeezed us in that same day.
Yeah.
Warren got in an Uber and picked up Janelle from school, and they headed to Harborview to see a new ophthalmologist. Here is where we mention that Warren is no civilian, but a radio producer and an intern on this show. So once they started seeing doctors, he started recording.
And then within the past week, it feels like... I was dreading that I was going to go blind, and I had maybe... like 2 years or maybe a little bit more to go. And so I had to make some really drastic decisions right away and try to learn how to be blind before I'm blind. I don't know. I think that's what I was thinking.
And everything's happening in both eyes. That's okay.
She ran tests and she just, you know, had incredible bedside manner. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we were breaking down at that point. We were just like, you know, this is the moment. Like, we're going to get the news. And we were, you know, pretty sure that it was going to happen.
I mean, they're a serious big deal. I mean, you know, every part of your body is really important, but, you know, I mean, it's scary when things happen to your eyes. And
it is.
I mean, after working here, I just feel like I try not to take my own eyes for granted. Because, and the doctors...
Every doctor that came in after that was just... super thorough and like really patient and listened. Movement, or I'm not really sure what is triggering it. What I'm studying involves me staring at a computer for hours, and so.
So the patient feels compelled, like you said, to kind of blink?
Yeah, like blink really fast so I can refocus because.
To refocus.
And then. From there, it was kind of like, oh, this is what you have. We will figure all this out for you, and it's probably going to be bad, but not as bad as you think.
Then they saw one more doctor, and this guy gave them another surprising piece of news, the first good news they'd had in a long time.
So I can't really explain what he said, because I don't know exactly what he said, but I mean, the good news, you're 20/50, you have, you know, vision that can help you to do a lot of things that you like to do, and hopefully too with Sight Connection they can help to maximize your...
He tells Janelle she has 20/50 vision, and it seems like her vision loss has stopped.
Nice to meet you. You're very welcome. Yeah. And then, so go up to the front desk, and then, so ideally an appointment...
You can't know for sure, but it may well be that Janelle will not go blind, that her vision will stay pretty much the way it is now.
When the last doctor came in, I think I was just like so emotionally drained that I don't think I was even listening to him. I was just kind of like, okay, this is rare. How long do I have before I have like really horrible vision? Like I still wanted more and more and more answers. And they gave me so much information and they were so helpful, and I got more out of that one doctor's visit than I did out of, I don't know, gosh, seven or however many times I was going back and forth to the doctor. But I think going home and like letting it sink in a little bit and then doing my own research online is when I started to be more positive and more confident, or not confident, but more accepting, I suppose.
But we did go out to celebrate, basically, right after the doctor's visit.
I don't remember that. You have a really good memory. I don't remember.
Well, I recorded it.
I don't know. It was a really powerful experience, and I don't feel like I'm hopeless. Before I felt hopeless, and now I feel like, okay, now I can start from somewhere.
So that was in May, and I asked Janelle how she's been doing since then.
The world is pretty much pixelated. There are little white dots everywhere. I feel like I work a little bit harder because of it. I felt like I was about to lose my vision, and I felt really horrible at not getting my stuff together like sooner in my life, and going to school and trying to figure out what I wanted to do. And I was just like, you really miss so many opportunities, and now you don't have those. And since I got better news, I feel like I got a second chance.
All this happened when Warren and Janelle had been married for less than 2 years. And so I had to know, what had this taught them about each other?
I think it was just surprising to me how together you were throughout this. I didn't ever sense that you had given up.
I guess I learned that, yeah, we can really weather a storm. It was, throughout the whole thing, we were never, at each other's throats. It was always like, this is a thing we're facing together, and this is a challenge, but if we use each other as like lookouts, one of us will find a way to get to the hope, to get to the light, and whether or not that light comes from the outside or the inside.
Warren Langford is a radio producer based in Seattle. Janelle Langford continues her studies in design at Seattle Central College. Sound Effect comes to you from senior producer Arwen Nix and producer Kevin Kniestad. Big thanks to our interns, Casey Hicks, and doing double duty this week, Warren Langford. We get web help from Dave Nogueras, and our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. Thanks also this week to Kristen Woodward at Fred Hutch and to Tim Hofkin. Our podcast costs you nothing, and you can get it on iTunes. Rate us and leave a review while you're there. We'd also love to hear your feedback by email, soundeffect@kplu.org. Or tweet at KPLU or at Gabriel Spitzer. And Facebook, don't forget Facebook, we're on Facebook. Join us next week when we get all spooky.
On a scale of 1 to 10, you might call it like 6.5 or 7 on the gore level.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KPLU.